Hey guys, I'm Ellen Glover, and this is the Indiana University Bicentennial Podcast. It's Bloomington, Indiana, in 1945. Hoosiers are zipping around in their Buicks and Cadillacs on their way to the school's library in Franklin Hall. Young men walk around with their hair cropped and combed, clutching their school books. Young women do the same, wearing dresses that are shorter than ever due to the fabric shortages during World War II. But the war didn't just change women's fashion, it changed everything, especially college towns like Bloomington. When the war ended in 1945, the country welcomed back hundreds of thousands of young men, many of whom cut their higher education short or skipped out on it altogether in order to fight for their country. That's where the GI Bill came in. The bill was a novelty in 1945, ahead of its time. In a nutshell, the bill paid for the higher education of any qualified veteran who wanted it. In many cases, it covered full tuition, even the cost of books. It also gave a veteran a bit of money, about $50 each month, to live on. You know, pay rent, buy food, live comfortably. If the veteran was married, the amount raised to about $75 a month. The allowance would increase with each child that was born, too. Basically, the GI Bill allowed the veteran to get right back to regular life. They were usually at an age where marriage and children were a given, and they wouldn't have to sacrifice that in order to go to school. They could do both. There was just one problem with the GI Bill. Where was everyone going to go? More than 9,500 new students were due to move into Bloomington when school started in September of 1946. A large percentage of these students would be married veterans. In 1946, veteran enrollment at Indiana University was almost 6,000. This number far outnumbered the university's pre-war peak of student enrollment several years back. We're talking leaps and bounds. However, in that same year, housing in Bloomington was at an all-time low. During the Depression, people doubled up in houses since they couldn't afford their own. Then, when the war started, building was basically put to a full-on stop. Most of the houses that were available were so dilapidated that they were unusable. So, by 1946, there were about half the number of available houses and apartments as there were in 1930. This created a unique and frightening challenge for IU President Herman B. Wells and his administrative staff. The idea of turning away perfectly good students, not to mention veterans of World War II, because of the lack of housing was an option they dreaded. It would be horrible for business, not to mention unpatriotic. In fact, Wells took this issue so seriously that back in 1945, he sent the Board of Trustees to Wisconsin, away from all the politics of Bloomington and Indianapolis, to come up with a viable solution. They needed to figure out how to house the students on IU's surplus land. They also needed to figure out how to pay for it. Our knight in shining armor in this story is Ward G. Biddle. During a trip to Washington, D.C., Biddle spoke to some military officials and learned they were desperately trying to find a place for the hundreds of surplus house trailers left over from the war. It took some pushing, but Biddle was able to convince the government to hand over these trailers to colleges and universities. This opened the floodgates. Turns out a lot of schools were facing a similar problem. After receiving their share of trailers, IU almost immediately had to set out and look for 150 more. Soon, IU had enough of these trailers to create little villages with them. Property in Monroe County was at a premium, so these little trailer towns were packed full of shiny little metal barracks. There was barely any room between each individual trailer. All of them were painted beige for uniformity and had tar paper roofs and bases to keep the cold out. And the families came pouring in. Each village housed about 700 adults and some 175 children. Soon enough, these veterans of war were back in the army barracks they had spent months, even years in, not too long ago. But unlike in the army, colonels, captains, lieutenants, and privates alike all lived side by side, as equals. They all had different experiences. Some flew planes, others were army medics. Some went to places like Japan and New Guinea, others fought in Germany and other parts of Europe. And once they got to college, they all chose different things to study. Some studied chemistry, others business, and some people studied art or music. But all of them had one thing in common, the war. These men in the trailer towns grew close because of that common experience. The veterans' wives got close too. Many of them attended school along with their husbands, or they worked, or both. But many stayed home, especially if they had children. No matter what, these women became a unit of support for each other. The problems of one trailer became the problems of all. Women helped each other with the housework, childcare, anything. These trailer towns quickly became worlds unto themselves. Like the pioneers of the West that came to Indiana before them, these residents built their own society. They took care of each other. There was a sense of community in these trailer courts that couldn't be found anywhere else. Some of these little trailer towns were even self-governed. They had councils assigned to each section of the town, and any problems that came up were resolved that way. One of the villages, Woodlawn Court, even elected a mayor. However, in other trailer towns, problems and disputes that arose were resolved through a natural order of things. Impromptu meetings were called and votes were taken to find solutions. But it seems like disputes didn't happen that often in the trailer courts. In hindsight, this seems pretty incredible, especially since space was so cramped in these trailer towns, both inside and out. The entire interior of the barrack was covered in a shiny wood-like paneling. The stove, refrigerator, and sink were attached to the walls at the center of the trailer, right as you walked in. Then, on one end of the trailer, a divan and bookcase were provided as the living room essentials. A bedroom was at the other end. Sometimes a sliding door was provided to keep some extra privacy. Married couples were given a full-size bed instead of bunk beds if they requested it. The tiny homes were heated with cylindrical oil stoves placed at the center of the structure. And there was no running water in any of the trailers, but each little village had a number of trailer washrooms, strategically placed so no one had to walk more than 3 trailer lengths to get to the restroom. With that, going to the washroom became a sort of social event. Friends were made, news was spread. The group of people who shared the same washroom became quite close, and it was not uncommon to see a group of trailerites meandering around the washroom in their bathrobes. The residents also found social camaraderie in the community house, a grouping of 3 or 4 trailers at the center of the village. They mainly served as a community kitchen and laundry, but sometimes on weekend nights, the veterans and their wives would get babysitters for the kids and all meet at the community house for a night of dancing and fun. It was a chance to be real college students for once. Residents took some doors off their hinges, placed them on laundry tubs, and covered them in crepe paper to transform the laundry room into a club. The couples would drink and dance to Sammy Kay and Guy Lombardo all night long. But the trailer court residents didn't just sequester themselves in the trailers. They tried to be as active as possible in campus life. In fact, the school encouraged these veterans to get involved with the younger students because they were usually a lot more mature and reliable. Most of the trailer court residents were in their 20s, children really, but because men had been through war and women had family responsibilities, they acted differently than your average student. Women in school would participate in clubs and even rush into sororities. The men, if they weren't injured from war, would participate in intramural sports and fraternities. Financial hardship caused the trailer residents to be not as active in extracurricular activities as the other students, though. The need for surplus housing on IU's campus diminished over the next 5 years. Veterans graduated, and more dormitory and apartment buildings were being constructed by the university. In that time, dormitories like Wright Quadrangle, which are still used today, were being built. But when housing became less pinched and the university invited these veterans to move themselves and their families into more comfortable housing, many of the trailerites refused. They had been so accustomed to the ways of trailer living that they couldn't imagine living anywhere else. Many of these couples were newly married, and their entire life spent together revolved around the trailer. They learned how to be a cohesive, cooperative couple within the confines of the trailer and the community around it. Not only that, but the veterans were introduced back into civilian life in these trailers. In these homes, they learned how to be regular guys again, and their wives learned how to be women through their trailer lives. They learned how to take care of their husbands, as was expected at the time. In the end, the Trailerites moved on to do bigger and better things. Many of them got out of Bloomington and became successful people, but I'll bet they never forgot their time in the trailer court, where nothing mattered except your friends and family, the people you loved. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Keep an eye out for more podcasts about Indiana University. I'm Ellen Glover, and this was the Indiana University Bicentennial Podcast.